This is Rachel, recording for Radio Talking Book Network in Omaha, Nebraska. I will be reading Bookshelf, starting with Part 6 of Bram Stoker's Dracula. "Good boy," said Van Helsing. "In the not so far off, you will be happy that you have done all for her you love. Come now, and be silent. You shall kiss her once before it is done. But then you must go, and you must leave at my sign. Say no word to Madame. You know how it is with her. There must be no shock. Any knowledge of this would be one. Come." We all went up to Lucy's room. Arthur, by direction, remained outside. Lucy turned her head and looked at us, but said nothing. She was not asleep, but she was simply too weak to make the effort. Her eyes spoke to us. That was all. Van Helsing took some things from his bag and laid them on a little table out of sight. Then he mixed a narcotic and, coming over to the bed, said cheerily, "Now, little miss, here is your medicine. Drink it off like a good child. See, I lift you so that the swallow is easy. Yes." She had made the effort with success. It astonished me how long the drug took to act. This, in fact, marked the extent of her weakness. The time seemed endless until sleep began to flicker in her eyelids. At last, however, the narcotic began to manifest its potency, and she fell into a deep sleep. When the professor was satisfied, he called Arthur into the room and bade him strip off his coat. Then he added, "You may take that one little kiss whilst I bring over the table. Friend John, help to me." So neither of us looked whilst he bent over her. Van Helsing, turning to me, said, "He is so young and strong, and of blood so pure, that we need not defibrinate it." Then with swiftness, but with absolute method, Van Helsing performed the operation. As the transfusion went on, something like life seemed to come back to poor Lucy's cheeks, and though Arthur's growing pallor, the joy of his face seemed absolutely to shine. After a bit, I began to grow anxious, for the loss of blood was telling on Arthur, strong man as he was. It gave me an idea of what terrible strain Lucy's system must have undergone, that what weakened Arthur only partially restored her. But the professor's face was set, and he stood watch in hand, and his eyes fixed now on the patient and now on Arthur. I could hear my own heartbeat. Presently he said in a soft voice, "Do not stir an instant. It is enough. You attend him, I will look to her." When all was over, I could see how much Arthur was weakened. I dressed the wound and took his arm to bring him away. When Van Helsing spoke without turning around, the man seems to have eyes in the back of his head. The brave lover, I think, deserve another kiss, which he shall have presently. And as he had now finished his operation, he adjusted the pillow to the patient's head. As he did so, the narrow black velvet band, which she seemed always to wear around her throat, buckled with an old diamond buckle which her lover had given her, was dragged a little up, and showed a red mark on her throat. Arthur did not notice it, but I could hear the deep hiss of indrawn breath, which is one of Van Helsing's ways of betraying emotion. He said nothing at the moment, but turned to me, saying, "Now take our brave young lover, give him of the port wine, and let him lie down a while. He must then go home and rest, sleep much, and eat much, that he may be recruited of what he is so given to his love. He must not stay here. Hold, a moment. I may take it, sir, that you are anxious of result. Then bring it with you that in all ways the operation is successful. You have saved her life this time, and you can go home and rest easy in mind that all that can be is. I shall tell her all when she is well. She shall love you none the less for what you have done. Goodbye." When Arthur had gone, I went back into the room. Lucy was sleeping gently, but her breathing was stronger. I could see the counterpane move as her breast heaved. By the bedside sat Van Helsing, looking at her intently. The velvet band again covered the red mark. I asked the professor in a whisper, "What do you make of that mark on her throat?" "What do you make of it?" "I have not seen it yet," I answered, and then and there proceeded to loose the band. Just over the external jugular vein, there were two punctures. Not large, but not wholesome-looking. There was no sign of disease, but the edges were white and worn-looking, as if by some trituration. It at once occurred to me that this wound, or whatever it was, might be the means of that manifest loss of blood. But I abandoned the idea as soon as it formed, for such a thing could not be. The whole bed would have been drenched with the scarlet of the blood of the girl that she must have lost to leave such a pallor as she had before the transfusion. Well, said Van Helsing. Well, said I can make nothing of it. The professor stood up. I must go back to Amsterdam tonight, he said. There are books and things there which I want. You must remain here all the night, and you must not let your sight pass from her. Shall I have a nurse? I asked. We are the best nurses, you and I. You must keep watch all night. See that she is well fed and that nothing disturbs her. You must not sleep all the night. Later on we can sleep, you and I. I shall be back so soon as possible, then we may begin. May begin, I said. What on earth do you mean? We shall see, he answered as he hurried out. He came back a moment later and put his head inside the door and said, with warning finger held up, Remember, she is your charge. If you leave her and harm befall, you shall not sleep easy hereafter. Dr. Seward's diary continued. 8th of September. I sat up all night with Lucy. The opiate worked itself off toward dusk, and she had waked naturally. She looked a different being from what she had before the operation. Her spirits were good, and she was full of a happy vivacity, but I could see evidences of the absolute prostration which she had undergone. When I told Mrs. Westenra that Dr. Van Helsing had directed that I should sit up with her, she almost pooh-poohed the idea, pointing out her daughter's renewed strength and excellent spirits. I was firm, however, and made preparations for my long vigil. When her maid had prepared for her the night I came in, having in the meantime had supper and took a seat by the bedside, she did not make in any way objection, but looked at me gratefully whenever I caught her eye. After a long spell, she seemed sinking off to sleep, but with an effort seemed to pull herself together and took it off. This was repeated several times, but with greater effort and with shorter pauses as the time moved on. It was apparent that she did not want to go to sleep, so I tackled the subject at once. You do not want to go to sleep? No, I am afraid. Afraid to go to sleep? Why so? It is the boon we all crave for. Ah, not if you were like me. If sleep was to you a presage of horror. A presage of horror? What on earth do you mean? I don't know. Oh, I don't know. And that is what is so terrible. All this weakness comes to me in sleep until I dread the very thought. But my dear girl, you may sleep tonight. I am here watching you, and I can promise that nothing will happen. Ah, I can trust you. I seized the opportunity and said, I promise you that if I see any evidence of bad dreams, I will wake you at once. You will? Oh, will you really? How good you are to me. Then I will sleep. And almost to the word, she gave a deep sigh of relief and sank back asleep. All night long I watched by her. She never stirred, but slept on and on in a deep, tranquil, life-giving, health-giving sleep. Her lips were slightly parted, and her breast rose and fell with the regularity of a pendulum. There was a smile on her face, and it was evident that no bad dreams had come to disturb her peace of mind. In the early morning her maid came, and I left her in her care, and took myself back home, for I was anxious about many things. I sent a short wire to Van Helsing and to Arthur, telling of the excellent result of the operation. My own work, with its manifold arrears, took me all day to clear off. It was dark when I was able to inquire my zoophagus patient. The report was good. He had been quite quiet for the past day and night. A telegram came from Van Helsing at Amsterdam whilst I was at dinner, suggesting that I should be at Hillingham tonight, as it might well be to be at hand, stating he would be leaving by the night mail and would join me early in the morning. 9th of September. I was pretty tired and worn out when I got to Hillingham. For two nights I had hardly a wink of sleep, and my brain was beginning to feel that numbness which marks cerebral exhaustion. Lucy was up and in cheerful spirits. When she shook hands with me, she looked sharply in my face and said, No sitting up tonight for you. You're all worn out. I'm quite well again. Indeed, I am, and if there is to be any sitting up, it is I who will sit up with you. I would not argue the point, but went and had my supper. Lucy came with me, and enlivened by her charming presence, I made an excellent meal, and had a couple of glasses of the more than excellent port. Then Lucy took me upstairs and showed me a room next to her own where a cozy fire was burning. "Now," she said, "you must stay here. I'll leave this door open, and my door too. You can lie on the sofa. So, for I know that nothing would induce any of you doctors to go to bed whilst there's a patient above the horizon. If I want anything, I shall call out, and you can come to me at once." I could not but acquiesce, for I was dog-tired, and could have not have sat up had I tried. So, on her renewing her promise to call me if she should want anything, I lay on the sofa and forgot about everything. Lucy Westenra's Diary. 9th of September. I feel so happy tonight. I have been so miserably weak that to be able to think and move about is like feeling sunshine after a long spell of east wind out of a steel sky. Somehow Arthur feels very, very close to me. I seem to feel his presence warm about me. I suppose it is that sickness and weakness are selfish things, and turn our inner eyes and sympathy on ourselves, whilst health and strength give love rein, and in thought and feeling he can wander where he wills. I know where my thoughts are. If Arthur only knew. My dear, your ears must tingle as you sleep, as mine do waking. Oh, the blissful rest of last night! How I slept with that dear, good Dr. Seward watching me! And tonight I shall fear not to sleep, since he is close at hand and within call. Thank everybody for being so good to me. Thank God. Good night, Arthur. Dr. Seward's Diary. 10th of September. I was conscious of the professor's hand on my head and started awake in all of a second. That is one of the things that we learn in the asylum, at any rate. How is the patient? Well, when I left her, or rather, when she left me, I answered. Come, let us see, he said, and together we went into the room. The blind was down, and I went over to raise it gently whilst Van Helsing stepped with his soft cat-like tread over to the bed. As I raised the blind, and in the morning sunlight flooded the room, I heard the professor's low hiss of inspiration, and knowing its rarity, a deadly fear shot through my heart. As I passed over, he moved back, and his exclamation of horror, "Gott in Himmel," needed no enforcement from his agonized face. He raised his hand and pointed to the bed, and his iron face was drawn and ashen white. I felt my knees begin to tremble. There on the bed, seemingly in a swoon, lay poor Lucy, more horribly white and wan-looking than ever. Even the lips were white, and the gums seemed to have shrunken back from the teeth, as we sometimes see in a corpse after a prolonged illness. Van Helsing raised his foot to stamp in anger, but the instinct of his life and all the long years of habit stood to him, and he put down again softly. "Quick," he said, "bring the brandy." I flew into the dining room and returned with the decanter. He wetted the poor white lips with it, and together we rubbed palm and wrist and heart. He felt her heart, and after a few moments of agonizing suspense, he said, "It is not too late. It beats, though but feebly. All our work is undone. We must begin again. There is no young Arthur here now. I have to call on you yourself this time, friend John." As he spoke, he was dipping into his bag and producing the instruments for transfusion. I had taken off my coat and rolled up my shirt sleeve. There was no possibility of an opiate just at present, and no need of one, and so, without a moment's delay, we began the operation. After a time, it did not seem a short time either, for the draining away of one's blood, no matter how willingly it is given, is a terrible feeling. Van Helsing held up a warning finger. "Do not stir," he said, "but I fear that with growing strength she may wake, and that would make danger, oh, much danger. But I shall precaution take. I shall give hypodermic injection of morphia." He proceeded then, swiftly and deftly, to carry out his intent. The effect on Lucy was not bad, for the faint seemed to merge subtly into the narcotic sleep. It was with the feeling of personal pride that I could see a faint tinge of color steal back into the pallid cheeks and lips. No man knows, till he experiences it, what it is to feel his own lifeblood drawn away into the veins of the woman he loves. The professor watched me critically. "That will do," he said. "Already?" I remonstrated. "You took a great deal more than art." To which he smiled a sad sort of smile as he replied, "He, his, her lover, her fiancé. You have work, much work to do for her and others, and the present will suffice." When we stopped the operation, he attended to Lucy, whilst I applied digital pressure on my own incision. I lay down whilst I waited his leisure to attend on me, for I felt faint and a little sick. By and by he bound up my wound and sent me downstairs to get a glass of wine for myself. As I was leaving the room, he came after me and half whispered, "Mind, nothing must be said of this. If our young lover should turn up unexpected, as before, no word to him. It would at once frighten him and enjealous him too, so there must be none. Go." When I came back, he looked at me carefully, and then said, "You are not much the worse. Go into the room and lie on your sofa and rest a while. Then have much breakfast, and come here to me." I followed out his orders, for I knew how right and wise they were. I had done my part, and now my next duty was to keep up my strength. I felt very weak, and in the weakness lost something of the amazement at what had occurred. I fell asleep on the sofa, however, wondering again and again how Lucy could have made such a retrograde movement, and how she could have been drained of so much blood with no sign anywhere to show for it. I think I must have continued my wonder in my dreams, for sleeping and waking my thoughts always came back to the little punctures in her throat, and the ragged, exhausted appearance of their edges, tiny though they were. Lucy slept well into the day, and when she woke she was fairly well and strong, though not nearly so much as the day before. When Van Helsing had seen her, he went out for a walk, leaving me in charge, with strict injunctions that I was not to leave her for a moment. I could hear his voice in the hall, asking the way to the nearest telegraph office. Lucy chatted with me freely and seemed quite unconscious that anything had happened. I tried to keep her amused and interested. When her mother came up to see her, she did not notice any change whatsoever, but said to me gratefully, "We owe you so much, Dr. Seward, for all you have done, but you really must now take care not to overwork yourself. You're looking pale yourself. You want a wife to nurse and look after you a bit. That you do." As she spoke, Lucy turned crimson, though it was only momentarily, for her poor, wasted veins could not stand for as long such an unwanted drain to the head. The reaction came in excessive pallor as she turned imploring eyes on me. I smiled and nodded and laid my finger on my lips with a sigh, and she sank back amid her pillows. Van Helsing returned in a couple of hours and presently said to me, "Now you go home and eat much and drink enough. Make yourself strong. I stay here tonight, and I shall sit up with little miss myself. You and I must watch the case, and we must have none other to know. I have grave reasons. No, do not ask them. Think what you will. Do not fear to think even the most not probable. Good night." In the hall, two of the maids came to me and asked if they or either of them might not sit up with Miss Lucy. They implored me to let them. And when I said it was Dr. Van Helsing's wish that either he or I should sit up, they asked me quite piteously to intercede with the foreign gentleman. I was much touched by their kindness. Perhaps it is because I am weak at present, or perhaps it was on Lucy's account that their devotion was manifested, for over and over again I have seen similar instances of woman's kindness. I got back here in time for a late dinner, went on my rounds, all well, and set this down while waiting to sleep. It is coming. 11th of September. This afternoon I went over to Hillingham, found Van Helsing in excellent spirits, and Lucy much better. Shortly after I arrived, a big parcel came from abroad for the professor. He opened it with much impressment, assumed, of course, and showed a great bundle of white flowers. "These are for you, Miss Lucy," he said. "For me? Oh, Dr. Van Helsing! Yes, my dear, but not for you to play with. These are medicines." Here Lucy made a wry face. "Nay, they are not to take in the decoction or in nauseous form, so you need not snub that so charming nose, and I shall point out to my friend Arthur that woes he may have to endure in seeing so much beauty that he loves so much distort. Aha, my pretty miss, that bring the so nice nose all straight again. This is medicinal, but you do not know how. I put him in your window, I make pretty wreath, and I hang him round your neck so that you sleep well. Oh yes, they, like the lotus flower, make your trouble forgotten. It smells so like the waters of Lethe and of that fountain of youth that the conquistadores sought for in the Floridas and find him all too late. Whilst he was speaking, Lucy had been examining the flowers and smelling them. Now she threw them down, saying with half laughter and half disgust, "Oh, Professor, I believe you're only putting a joke on me. Why, these flowers are only common garlic." To my surprise, Van Helsing rose up and said with all of his sternness, his iron jaw set and his bushy eyebrows meeting, "No trifling with me. I never jest. There is grim purpose in all I do, and I warn you that you do not thwart me. Take care for the sake of others, if not for your own." Then, seeing poor Lucy scared, as she might well be, he went on more gently, "Oh, little miss, my dear, do not fear me. I only do for your good. But there is so much virtue in you, in those so common flower. See, I place them myself in your room. I make myself the wreath you are to wear. But hush, no telling to others that make so inquisitive questions. We must obey, and silence is part of obedience. And obedience is to bring you strong and well into loving arms that wait for you. Now, sit still a while. Come with me, friend John, and you shall help me deck the room with my garlic, which is all the way from Haarlem, where my friend Vanderpool raise herb in his glass houses all the year. I had to telegraph yesterday, or they would not have been here." We went to the room, taking the flowers with us. The professor's actions were certainly odd, and not to be found in any pharmacopoeia that I had ever heard of. First he fastened up the windows and latched them securely. Next, taking a handful of the flowers, he rubbed them all over the sashes, as to ensure every whiff of the air that might get in would be laden with the garlic smell. Then, with the wisp, he rubbed all over the jamb of the door, above, below, at each side, and round the fireplace the same way. It all seemed so grotesque to me, and presently I said, "Well, Professor, I know you always have a reason for what you do, but this certainly puzzles me. It is well we have no skeptic here, or he would say you'd be working some spell to keep out an evil spirit." "Perhaps I am," he answered quietly, as he began to make the wreath which Lucy was to wear around her neck. We then waited while Lucy made her toilet for the night, and when she was in bed, he came and fixed himself the wreath of garlic round her neck. The last words he said to her were, "Take care you do not disturb it. And even if the room feel close, do not tonight open the window or the door." "I promise," said Lucy, "and thank you both 1,000 times for all your kindness to me. Oh, what have I done to be blessed with such friends?" As we left the house in my fly, which was waiting, Van Helsing said, "Tonight I can sleep in peace, and sleep I want. 2 nights of travel, much reading in the day between, so much anxiety on the day to follow, and a night to sit up without a wink. Tomorrow in the morning early you call for me, and we come together to see our pretty miss, so much more strong for my spell, which I have work. Ho, ho." He seemed so confident that I, remembering my own confidence 2 nights before, and with the baneful result, felt awe and vague terror. It must have been my weakness that made me hesitate to tell my friend, but I felt it all the more, like unshed tears. Lucy Westenra's Diary. 12th of September. How good they all are to me. I quite love that dear Mr. Van Helsing. I wonder why he was so anxious about these flowers. He positively frightened me, he was so fierce. And yet he must have been right, for I feel comfort from them already. Somehow I do not dread being alone tonight, and I can go to sleep without fear. I shall not mind any flapping outside the window. Oh, the terrible struggle I've had against sleep so often of late. The pain of the sleeplessness, or the pain of the fear of sleep, with such unknown horrors as it has for me. How blessed are some people whose lives have no fears, no dreads, to whom sleep is a blessing that comes nightly and brings nothing but sweet dreams. Well, here I am tonight, hoping for sleep, and lying like Ophelia in the play with the virgin crants and maiden struments. I've never liked garlic before, but tonight it's delightful. There is peace in its smell. I feel sleep coming already. Good night, everybody. Dr. Seward's Diary. 13th of September. Called at the Berkeley and found Van Helsing, as usual, up to time. The carriage ordered from the hotel was waiting. The professor took his bag, which he always brings with him now. Let all be put down exactly. Van Helsing and I arrived at Hillingham at 8 o'clock. It was a lovely morning. The bright sunshine and all the fresh feeling of early autumn seemed like the completion of nature's annual work. The leaves were turning all kinds of beautiful colors, but had not yet begun to drop from the trees. When we entered, we met Mrs. Westenra coming out of the morning room. She always was an early riser. She greeted us warmly and said, "You'll be glad to know that Lucy's better. The dear child is still asleep. I looked into her room but did not go in, lest I should disturb her." The professor smiled and looked quite jubilant. He rubbed his hands together and said, "Ah, I thought I had diagnosed the case. My treatment is working." To which she answered, "Well, you must not take all the credit to yourself, doctor. Lucy's state this morning is in part due to me." "How do you mean, ma'am?" asked the professor. "Well, I was anxious about the dear child in the night and went into her room. She was sleeping soundly, so soundly that even my coming would not wake her. But the room was awfully stuffy, and there was a lot of those horrible, strong-smelling flowers about everywhere, and she actually had a bunch of them around her neck. I feared that the heavy odor would be too much for the dear child in her dear state, so I took them all away and opened a bit of the window to let in a little fresh air. You will be pleased with her, I'm sure." She moved off into her boudoir, where she breakfasted early. As she had spoken, I watched the professor's face and saw it turn ashen gray. He had been able to retain his self-command whilst the poor lady was present, but he knew her state and how mischievous his shock would be. He actually smiled on her as he held open the door for her to pass through the room. But the instant she disappeared, he pulled me suddenly and forcibly into the dining room and closed the door. Then, for the first time in my life, I saw Van Helsing break down. He rubbed his hands over his head in a sort of mute despair, then beat his palms together in a helpless way. Finally, he sat down on the chair, putting his hands before his face, and began to sob with loud, dry sobs that seemed to come from the very racking of his heart. Then he raised his arms again, as though appealing to the whole universe. "God, God, God," he said, "what have we done? What has this poor thing done that we are so sore beset? Is there fate amongst us still, sent down from the pagan world of old, that such things must be, and in such way? This poor mother, all unknowing, and for all the best she does think, does such thing as lose her daughter, body and soul, and we must not tell her, we must not even warn her, or she will die, and then both die. Oh, how we are beset, how all the powers of the devil is against us." Suddenly he jumped to his feet. "Come," he said, "come, we must see and act. Devils or no devils, or all the devils at once, it matters not, we fight him all the same." He went to the hall door for his bag, and together we went up into Lucy's room. Once again I drew up the blind whilst Van Helsing went towards the bed. This time he did not start as he looked on the poor face with the same awful waxen pallor as before. He wore a look of stern sadness and infinite pity. "As expected," he murmured, and with that hissing inspiration of his that meant so much. Without a word he went and locked the door, and then began to set out on the little table the instruments for yet another operation of transfusion of blood. I had long ago recognized the necessity and began to take off my coat, but he stopped me with a warning hand. "No," he said, "today you must operate. I shall provide. You are weakened already." As he spoke, he took off his coat and rolled up his shirt sleeve. Again the operation, again the narcotic, again some return of color to the ashy cheeks, and the regular breathing of healthy sleep. This time I watched whilst Van Helsing recruited himself and rested. Presently he took the opportunity of telling Mrs. Westenra that she must not remove anything from Lucy's room without consulting him, that the flowers were of medicinal value, and the breathing of the odor was part of a system of cure. Then he took over the case himself, saying he would watch this night and the next, and would send me word when to come. After another hour, Lucy waked from her sleep, fresh and bright, and seemingly not much the worse for her terrible ordeal. What does it all mean? I'm beginning to wonder if my long habit of life amongst the insane is beginning to tell upon my own brain. Lucy Westenra's Diary, 17th of September. 4 days and nights of peace. I'm getting so strong again that I hardly know myself. It is as if I had passed through some long nightmare and had just awakened to see the beautiful sunshine and feel the fresh air of the morning around me. I have a dim half-remembrance of long, anxious times of waiting and fearing, darkness in which there was not even the pain of hope to make present distress more poignant, and then long spells of oblivion and the rising back to life as a diver coming up through a great press of water. Since, however, Dr. Van Helsing has been with me, all this bad dreaming seems to have passed away. The noises that used to frighten me out of my wits, the flapping against the windows, the distant voices which seemed so close to me, the harsh sounds which came from I knew not where and commanded me to do I know not what, have all ceased. I go to bed now without any fear of sleep. I do not even try to stay awake. I have grown quite fond of the garlic, and a boxful arrives for me every day from Haarlem. Tonight Dr. Van Helsing is going away, for he has to be in a day for Amsterdam. But I need not be watched. I'm well enough to be left alone. Thank God for my mother's sake, and dear Arthur's, and for all of our friends that have been so kind. I shall not even fear the change, for last night Dr. Van Helsing slept in his chair a lot of the time. I found him asleep twice when I woke. But I did not fear to go to sleep again, although the boughs or bats or something flapped almost angrily against the window panes. The Pall Mall Gazette, 18th of September. The Escaped Wolf. Perilous adventure of our interviewer. Interview with the keeper of the Zoological Gardens. After many inquiries and almost as many refusals, and perpetually using the words Pall Mall Gazette as a sort of talisman, I managed to find the keeper of the section of the Zoological Gardens in which the wolf department is included. Thomas Builder lives in one of the cottages in the enclosure behind the elephant house, and was just sitting down to his tea when I found him. Thomas and his wife are hospitable folk, elderly, and without children, and if the specimen I enjoyed of their hospitality be of the average kind, their lives must be pretty comfortable. The keeper would not enter on what he called business until supper was over and we were all satisfied. Then, when the table was cleared and he had lit his pipe, he said, "Now, sir, you can go on and ask me what you want. You'll excuse me refusing to talk about professional subjects after meals. I gives the wolves and the jackals and the hyenas and all our section their tea before I begin to ask them questions." "What do you mean, ask them questions?" I queried, wishful to get him in a talkative humor. "In them of them over the head with the pole one way, scratching their ears another, when gents is flush, wants a bit of a show off for their girls. I don't mind so much the fuss. I'm sitting with a pole after I chucks in their dinner, but I waits till they've had their sherry and coffee, so to speak, before I tries on with the ear scratching. Mind you," he added philosophically, "there's a deal of the same nature of us as in them there animals. Here's you coming and asking me questions about my business, and I that grumpy-like, and only for your bloomin' arfid that I've seen you bust for I answer. Not even when you ask me sarcastic-like if I liked to ask the superintendent to ask me questions. Without offense, did I tell her to go to hell? You did. And when you said you'd report me for using obscene language, and it was fitting me over the head, and the arfid made all that all right. I weren't going to fight, so I waited for the food and did my owl as the wolves and lions and tigers does. But Lord love your art, now the old human has a chunk of her tea cake in me and rinsed me out with her bloomin' old teapot, and I've lit up. You may scratch my ears for all you're worth, and won't even get a growl out of me. Drive along with your questions. I know what you're coming at, that escaped wolf." "Exactly. I want you to give your view of it. Just tell me how it happened. And when I know of the facts, I'll get you to say that you will, what you will consider was the cause of it, and how you think the whole affair will end." "All right, Governor. This here about the whole story. That air wolf we call Berserker was one of the three gray ones that came from Norway to Jamrax, which we bought off him for a year ago. Was a nice, well-behaved wolf that never gave no trouble to talk of. I'm more surprised at him for wanting to get out, nor any other animal in the place. But there you can't trust wolves no more, nor women." "Don't you mind him, sir," broke in Mrs. Tom with a cheery laugh. "He's got mind in the animals so long that blessed if he ain't an old wolf himself, but there ain't no harm in him." "Well, sir, it was about 2 hours after feeding yesterday when I first heard any disturbance. I was making up a litter in the monkey house for a young puma which was ill, when I heard the yelping and howling, and I came away straight. There was Berserker a-tearing like a mad thing at the bars as if he wanted to get out. There wasn't much people about that day, and close at hand was only one man, a tall, thin chap with a hook nose and a pointed beard and a few white hairs running through it. He had a hard, cold look, and red eyes, and I sort of misliked to him, for it seemed as if it was him they were irritated at. He had white kid gloves on his hands, and he pointed out the animals to me and said, 'Keeper, these wolves seem upset at something.' Maybe it's you, says I, for I did not like the airs he give hisself. He didn't get angry, as I hoped he would, but he smiled a sort of insolent smile, with a white mouth full of white sharp teeth. Oh no, they wouldn't like me, he says. Oh yes they would, says I, imitating of him. They always likes a bone or two to clean their teeth on about tea time, which you is a bag full. Well, it was an odd thing, but when the animal sees us a-talking, they lay down. And when I went over to Berserker, he lets me stroke his ears, same as ever. That there man came over, and blessed as if he didn't put his hand and stroke the old wolf's ears, too. Take care, says I, Berserker's quick. Never mind, he says, I'm used to him. Are you in the business yourself, I says, taking to keep my hat for a man who trades in wolves, and Centerer is a good friend to keepers. No, says he, not exactly in the business, but I've made pets of several. And with that, he lifts his hat as purlite as a lord and walks away. Old Berserker kept looking after him till he was out of sight, then went down and lay in a corner and wouldn't come out of the whole evening. Well, last night, soon as the moon was up, the wolves here all howling. There weren't nothing for him to howl at. There weren't no one near except some one that was evidently a calling dog somewhere in the back of the gardens out in the park. And once or twice I went out to see if all was right, and it was. And then the howling stopped. Just before 12 o'clock, I took a look round the turning, and bust me, but when I came opposite to old Berserker's cage, I see the rails broken and twisted about and the cage empty. And that's all I know for certain. Did anyone else see anything? One of our gardeners had coming home about that time from Harmony, and he sees a big gray dog coming out from the garden edges. At least he says so, but I don't give it much for it myself. And if he didn't ever say a word about it to his missus when he got home, and it was only after the escape of Wolf was made known, and we'd been up all night hunting in the park for Berserker, that he remembered seeing anything. My own belief was that the Harmony got to his head. Now, Mr. Builder, can you account in any way for the escape of the wolf? Well, sir, he said, with a suspicious sort of modesty, I think I can, but I don't certainly know as how you'd be satisfied with the theory. Well, certainly I shall, if a man like you, who knows the animals from experience, can't hazard a good guess at any rate. Well, who even then is to try? Well, then, sir, I accounts for it this way. It seems to me that your wolf escaped simply because he wanted to get out. From the hearty way that both Thomas and his wife laughed at the joke, I could see that it has done service before, and that the whole explanation was merely an elaborate sell. I couldn't cope in badinage with the worthy Thomas, but I thought I knew a surer way to his heart, so I said, Now, Mr. Builder, we'll consider that first half-sovereign worked off, and this brother of his is waiting to be claimed when you told me what you think will happen. All right, yar, sir, he said briskly. You'll excuse me, I know, for chafing of you. But the old woman here winked at me, which was as telling me to go on. Well, I never, said the old lady. Well, my opinion is this, that our wolf is a hiding of somewhere. The gardener, what, didn't remember what he was a-galloping northward faster than a horse could go, but I don't believe him. For, you see, sir, wolves don't gallop no more than dogs do. They not be being built that way. Wolves is fine things in a storybook, and I dey say when they gets in packs and does be chivying something, that is more afeard when they can be made a devil of a noise and chop it up, whatever it is. But, Lord bless you, in real life, a wolf is only a low creature, not half so clever or bold as a good dog, and not half as quarter of a much as fight in them. This one ain't been used to fighting, or even to providing for hisself. And more like he's somewhere around the park and hiding, shivering off, and if he thinks at all, wondering where he is to get his breakfast from. Maybe he's got down some area and is in a coal cellar. My eye, wouldn't some cook get a rum start when she sees his green eyes a-shining out at her in the dark? If he can't get food, he's bound to look for it, and mayhap he may chance to light on a butcher shop in time. If he doesn't, then some nursemaid goes off walking off with a soldier, leaving of the hip faint in the perambulator, well, then I shouldn't be surprised if the census is one babby the less. That's all. I was handing him the half-sovereign, when something came bobbing up against the window, and Mr. Builder's face doubled its natural length with surprise. Well, God bless me, he said, if there ain't Berserker come back by himself. He went to the door and opened it. A most unnecessary proceeding, it seemed to me. I've always thought that a wild animal never looks so well as when some obstacle of pronounced durability is between us. A personal experience has intensified rather than diminished that idea. After all, however, there is nothing like custom, for neither Builder nor his wife thought any more of the wolf than I should of a dog. The animal itself was as peaceful and well-behaved as that father of all picture wolves, Red Riding Hood's quondam friend, whilst moving her confidence in masquerade. The whole scene was an unutterable mixture of comedy and pathos. The wicked wolf, that for half a day had paralyzed London and set all the children in town shivering in their shoes, was there in a sort of penitent mood, and was received and petted like a sort of vulpine prodigal son. Old Builder had examined him all over with the most tender solicitude, and when he finished with his penitence, said, "Ere, I knew the old chap would get into some sort of trouble. Didn't I say it all along? Here's his head all cut and full of broken glass. He's been a-getting over some bloomin' wall or another. It's a shame that people are allowed to top their walls with broken bottles. This here's what comes of it. Come along, Berserker." He took the wolf and locked him up in a cage, with a piece of meat that satisfied, in quantity at any rate, the elementary conditions of the fatted calf, and went off to report. I came off, too, to report the only exclusive information that is given today regarding this strange escapade at the zoo. Dr. Seward's Diary, 17th of September. I was engaged after dinner in my study posting up my books, which, through press of other work and the many visits to Lucy, had fallen sadly into arrear. Suddenly the door was burst open, and in rushed my patient, with his face distorted with passion. I was thunderstruck, for such a thing as a patient getting out of his own accord into the superintendent's study was almost unknown. Without an instant's pause, he made straight at me. He had a dinner knife in his hand. As I saw he was dangerous, I tried to keep the table between us. He was too quick and strong for me, however, for before I could get my balance, he had struck at me and cut my left wrist rather severely. Before he could strike again, however, I got in my right and he was sprawling on the back of the floor. My wrist bled freely, and quite a little pool trickled onto the carpet. I saw that my friend was not intent on further effort and occupied myself binding up my wrist, keeping a wary eye on the prostrate figure all the time. When the attendants rushed in and we turned our attention to him, his employment positively sickened me. He was lying on his belly on the floor, licking up, like a dog, the blood which had fallen from my wounded wrist. He was easily secured, and to my surprise went with the attendants quite placidly, simply repeating over and over again, "The blood is the life. The blood is the life. I cannot afford to lose blood just at present. I have lost too much of late for my own physical good, and then the prolonged strain of Lucy's illness and its horrible phases is telling on me. I am overexcited and weary, and I need rest, rest, rest. Happily, Van Helsing has not summoned me, so I need not forego my sleep. Tonight I could not do well without it." Telegram, Van Helsing, Antwerp, to Seward, Carfax. Sent to Carfax, Sussex, as no county given. Delivered late by 22 hours. 17th of September. Do not fail to be at Hillingham tonight. If not watching all the time, frequently visit and see that the flowers are as placed. Very important. Do not fail. Shall be with you as soon as possible after arrival. Dr. Seward's Diary. 18th of September. Just off the train for London, the arrival of Van Helsing's telegram filled me with dismay. A whole night lost, and I know by bitter experience what may happen at night. Of course it is possible that all may have be well, but what may have happened? Surely there is some horrible doom hanging over us that every possible accident should thwart us in all we try to do. I shall take this cylinder with me, and then I can complete my entry on Lucy's phonograph. Memorandum left by Lucy Westenra. 17th of September. Night. I write this and leave it to be seen so that no one may by any chance get into any trouble through me. This is an exact record of what took place tonight. I feel I'm dying of weakness and have barely strength to write, but it must be done if I die in the doing. I went to bed as usual, taking care that the flowers were placed as Dr. Van Helsing directed, and soon fell asleep. I was waked by the flapping at my window, which had begun after the sleepwalking on the cliff at Whitby when Mina saved me, and which now I know so well. I was not afraid, but did not wish that Dr. Seward was in the room. as Dr. Van Helsing said he would be, so that I might have called him. I tried to go to sleep, but could not. Then there came to me the old fear of sleep, and I was determined to keep awake. Perversely, sleep would try to come then when I did not want it. So, as I feared to be alone, I opened my door and called out, "Is anybody there?" There was no answer. I was afraid to wake Mother, and so closed my door again. Then outside in the shrubbery, I heard a sort of howl like a dog's, but more fierce and deeper. I went to the window and looked out, but could see nothing except a big bat, which had evidently been buffeting its wings against the window. So I went back to bed again, but determined not to sleep. Presently the door opened, and Mother looked in. Seeing that by my moving I was not asleep, came in and sat by me. She said to me even more sweetly and softly than her wont, "I felt uneasy about you, darling, and came in to see that you were all right." I feared she might catch cold sitting there, so I asked her to come in and sleep with me. So she came into bed and lay down beside me. She did not take off her dressing gown, for she said she would only stay a while and then go back to her own bed. As she lay there in my arms and I in hers, the flapping and buffeting came to the window again. She was startled and a little frightened, and cried out, "What is that?" I tried to pacify her, and at last succeeded, and she lay quiet, but I could hear her poor heart still beating terribly. After a while there was the low howl again out in the shrubbery, and shortly after there was a crash at the window, and a lot of broken glass was hurled on the floor. The window blind blew back with the wind that rushed in, and in the aperture of the broken panes there was the head of a great, gaunt, gray wolf. Mother cried out in a fright and struggled into a sitting position, clutched wildly at anything that would help her. Amongst other things, she clutched at the wreath of flowers that Dr. Van Helsing insisted on my wearing around my neck and tore it away from me. For a second or two she sat up, pointing at the wolf, and there was a strange and horrible gurgling in her throat. And then she fell over, as if struck by lightning, and her head hit my forehead and made me dizzy for a moment or two. The room and all around seemed to spin. I kept my eyes fixed on the window, but the wolf drew his head back, and a myriad of little specks seemed to come blowing in through the broken window, and wheeling and circling round like a pillar of dust that travelers describe when there's a simoom in the desert. I tried to stir, but there was some spell on me, and dear Mother's poor body, which seemed to grow cold already, for her dear heart had ceased to beat, weighed me down, and I remembered no more for a while. The time did not seem long, but very, very awful, till I recovered consciousness again. Somewhere near, a passing bell was tolling. The dogs all round the neighborhood were howling, and in our shrubbery, seemingly just outside, a nightingale was singing. I was dazed and stupefied with pain and terror and weakness, but the sound of the nightingale seemed like the voice of my dead mother come back to comfort me. The sound seemed to have awakened the maids, too, for I could hear their bare feet pattering outside my door. I called to them, and they came in, and when they saw what lay over me in the bed, they screamed out. The wind rushed in through the broken window, and the door slammed to. They lifted off the body of my dear mother, and laid her, covered up with a sheet, on the bed after I had got up. They were all so frightened and nervous that I directed them to go to the dining room and have each a glass of wine. The door flew open for an instant and closed again. The maids shrieked, and then went in a body to the dining room, and I laid what flowers I had on my dear mother's breast. When they were there, I remembered what Dr. Van Helsing had told me, but I didn't like to remove them, and besides, I would have some of the servants to set up with me now. I was surprised when the maids did not come back. I called them, but got no answer, so I went to the dining room to look for them. My heart sank when I saw what happened. They all four lay helpless on the floor, breathing heavily. The decanter of sherry was on the table, half full, but there was a queer, acrid smell about it. I was suspicious and examined the decanter. It smelt of laudanum, and looking at the sideboard, I found that the bottle which Mother's doctor uses for her, was empty. What am I to do? What am I to do? I am back in the room with Mother. I cannot leave her, and I am alone. save for the sleeping servants who someone has drugged, alone with the dead. I dare not go out, for I can hear the low howl of the wolf through the broken window. The air seems full of specks, floating and circling in the draft from the window, and the lights burn blue and dim. What am I to do? God shield me from harm this night. I shall hide this paper in my breast, where they shall find it when they come to lay me out. My dear mother is gone. It is time I go too. Goodbye, dear Arthur, if I should not survive this night. God keep you, dear, and God help me. Dr. Seward's Diary, 18th of September. I drove at once to Hillingham and arrived early. Keeping my cab at the gate, I went up the avenue alone. I knocked gently and rang as quietly as possible, for I feared to disturb Lucy or her mother, and hoped to only bring a servant to the door. After a while, finding no response, I knocked and rang again. Still no answer. I cursed the laziness of the servants that they should lie abed at such an hour, for it was now 10 o'clock, and so rang and knocked again, but more impatiently, and still without response. Hitherto I blamed only the servants, but now a terrible fear began to assail me. Was this desolation but another link in the chain of doom which seemed to be drawing tight around us? Was it indeed a house of death to which I had come too late? I knew that minutes, even seconds of delay might mean hours of danger to Lucy if she had again one of those frightful relapses, so I went round the house to see if I could try to find by chance an entry elsewhere. I could find no means of ingress. Every window and door was fastened and locked, and I returned baffled to the porch. As I did so, I heard the rapid pit-pat of a swiftly driven horse's feet. They stopped up at the gate, and a few seconds later I met Van Helsing running up the avenue. When he saw me, he gasped out, "Then it was you, and just arrived. How is she? Are we too late? Did you not get my telegram?" I answered as quickly, as coherently as I could, that I'd only got his telegram early in the morning, and had not lost a minute in coming here, that I could not make anyone in the house hear me. He paused and raised his hat as he said solemnly, "Then I fear we are too late. God's will be done." With his usual recuperative energy, he went on, "Come, if there be no way to open to get in, we must make one. Time is all in all to us now." We went round to the back of the house, where there was a kitchen window. The professor took a small surgical saw from his case, and, handing it to me, pointed to the iron bars which guarded the window. I attacked them at once, and very soon cut through three of them. Then, with a long, thin knife, we pushed back the fastening of the sashes and opened the window. I helped the professor in and followed him. There was no one in the kitchen or the servants' rooms, which were close at hand. We tried all the rooms as we went along, and in the dining room, dimly lit by rays of light through the shutters, found 4 servant women lying on the floor. There was no need to think them dead, for their stertorous breathing and the acrid smell of laudanum in the room left no doubt as to their condition. Van Helsing and I looked at each other, and as we moved away, he said, "We can attend to them later." Then we ascended to Lucy's room. For an instant or two, we paused at the door to listen, but there was no sound we could hear. With white faces and trembling hands, we opened the door gently and entered the room. How can I describe what we saw? On the bed lay 2 women, Lucy and her mother. The latter lay furthest in, and she was covered with a white sheet, the edge of which had been blown back by the draught through the broken window, showing the drawn white face with a look of terror fixed upon it. By her side lay Lucy, her face white and still more drawn. The flowers which had been round her neck were found upon her mother's bosom, and her throat was bare, showing the 2 little wounds which we had noticed before, but looking horribly white and mangled. Without a word, the professor bent over the bed, his head almost touching poor Lucy's breast. Then he gave a quick turn of his head, as of one who listens, and leaping to his feet, he cried out to me, "It is not yet too late. Quick, quick, bring the brandy." I flew downstairs and returned to it, taking care to smell and taste it, lest it too be drugged, like the decanter of sherry which I found on the table. The maids were still breathing, but more restlessly, and I fancied that the narcotic was wearing off. I did not stay to make sure, but returned to Van Helsing. He rubbed the brandy, as on another occasion, on her lips and gums, and on her wrists and the palms of her hand. He said to me, I can do this, all that can be at the present. You go wake those maids. Flick them in the face with a wet towel. Flick them hard. Make them get heat and fire and a warm bath. This poor soul is nearly as cold as that beside her. She will need to be heated before we can do anything more. I went at once, and found a little difficulty in waking three of the women. The fourth was only a young girl, and the drug had evidently affected her more strongly, so I lifted her on the sofa and let her sleep. The others were dazed at first, but as remembrance came back to them, they cried and sobbed in a hysterical manner. I was stern with them, however, and would not let them talk. I told them that one life was bad enough to lose, and if that they delayed, they would sacrifice Miss Lucy. So sobbing and crying, they went about their way, half-clad as they were, and prepared fire and water. Fortunately, the kitchen and boiler fires were still active, and there was no lack of hot water. We got a bath, and carried Lucy out as she was, and placed her on it. Whilst we were busy chafing her limbs, there was a knock at the hall door. One of the maids ran off, hurried on some more clothes, and opened it. Then she returned and whispered to us that there was a gentleman who'd come with a message from Mr. Holmwood. I bade her simply tell him that he must wait, for we could see no one now. She went away with the message, and, engrossed with our work, I clean forgot all about him. I never saw in all my experience the professor work in such deadly earnest. I knew, as he knew, that it was a stand-up fight with death, and in a pause told him so. He answered me in a way I did not understand, but with the sternest look that his face could wear. If that were all, I would stop here, where we are now, and let her fade away in peace, for I see no light in life over her horizon. He went on with his work, with, if possible, renewed and more frenzied vigor. Presently, we both began to be conscious that the heat was beginning to be of some effect. Lucy's heart beat a trifle more audibly to the stethoscope, and her lungs had a perceptible movement. Van Helsing's face almost beamed, and as we lifted her from the bath and rolled her in a hot sheet to dry, he said to me, "The first gain is ours. Check to the king." We took Lucy into another room, which had by now been prepared, and laid her in bed and forced a few drops of brandy down her throat. I noticed that Van Helsing tied a soft silk handkerchief round her throat. She was still unconscious, and was quite as bad as, if not worse than, we had ever seen her. Van Helsing called in to one of the women and told her to stay with her, and not to take her eyes off until we returned, and then beckoned me out of the room. "We must consult to as what is to be done," he said as we descended the stairs. In the hall, he opened the dining room door, and we passed in, he closing the door carefully behind him. The shutters had been opened, but the blinds were already drawn, with that obedience to the etiquette of death which the British woman of the lower classes always rigidly observes. The room was, therefore, dimly dark. It was, however, light enough for our purposes. Van Helsing's sternness was somewhat relieved by a look of perplexity. He was evidently torturing his mind about something, so I waited for an instant, and he spoke. "What are we to do now? Where are we to turn for help? We must have another transfusion of blood, and that soon, or that poor girl's life won't be worth an hour's purchase. You are exhausted already. I am exhausted, too. I fear to trust those women, even if they would have courage to submit. What are we to do for someone who will open his veins for her? What's the matter with me, anyhow?" The voice came from the sofa across the room, and its tones brought relief and joy to my heart, for they were those of Quincy Morris. Van Helsing started angrily at the first sound, but his face softened and a glad look came into his eyes as I cried out, "Quincy Morris!" and rushed towards him with outstretched hands. "What brought you here?" I cried as our hands met. "I guess art is the cause." He handed me a telegram. "Have not heard from Seward in 3 days, and am terribly anxious. Cannot leave. Father in the same condition. Send me word on how Lucy is. Do not delay. Holmwood." "I think I came just in the nick of time. I know you only have to tell me what to do." Van Helsing strode forward and took his hands, looking him straight in the eyes as he said, "A brave man's blood is the best thing on this earth when a woman is in trouble. You are a man, and make no mistake. Well, the devil may work against us for all he's worth, but God sends us men where we want them." Once again, we went through that ghastly operation. I have not the heart to go through the details. Lucy has got terrible shock, and it told on her more than before, for though plenty of blood went into her veins, her body did not respond to the treatment as well as on other occasions. Her struggle back into life was something frightful to see and hear. This has been Rachel Reading Bookshelf with part 6 of Bram Stoker's Dracula. Have a wonderful day.